Now, when it matters most, the straightforward facts. ABC News is America's number one news. Good Morning America, number one in the morning, 9 years running. World News Tonight with David Muir, number one in the evening with America's most watched newscast. 2020, the number one news magazine on Friday nights. The View, the number one daytime talk show. And ABC News Live, number one in streaming news. ABC News is America's number one news. The most powerful stories of our time, anytime. Nightline. Friday nights, 9, 8 central. True crime. Cinematic. Real life drama. Stunning. The unthinkable. Follow the clues. The hunt. True crime. 2020. Friday nights, 9, 8 central on ABC.
Admit it. These days, what you need to know
seems to change just about every day.
What is it that you really want to know? Need to know?
To help you not just get through your day,
but to make the most of it. Smarter.
Feel better.
Feel happier.
Well, how about a third hour of Good Morning America in the afternoon?
GMA 3, what you need to know. Lunchtime at 1 Eastern, 12 Central and Pacific on ABC. It's all about you.
ABC News, straightforward.
After the election,
former President Donald Trump continues to push lies about the 2020 election, and those false claims are arguably the catalyst for restrictive voting legislation being passed in states across the country.
Republicans across the country are uniting around a plan to fully secure every future election.
But the Biden administration is striking back. The Department of Justice filing suit against Georgia for its restrictive voting law.
The rights of all eligible citizens to vote are the central pillars of our democracy.
You will see that this is not suppression. This actually expands access.
It all comes as we wait for the nation's highest court to weigh in on voting rights. Senior Washington reporter Devin Dwyer is here to break down what we can expect. Devin, the voting rights case before the Supreme Court is all about Arizona. What exactly are the issues at hand that the justices are looking at?
Yeah, Avery, the case before the court is the biggest test of the Voting Rights Act in nearly a decade. And this is a high-stakes decision that's due any day now on two voting provisions in the state of Arizona. One, the state enacted a rule that tosses out any ballot that's cast in the wrong precinct. The other rule is a ban on ballot collection by third parties, so-called ballot harvesting. You know, community groups or campaigns collecting those ballots and turning them in. Arizona Republicans wanted to make that illegal.
Because it puts us at a competitive disadvantage relative to Democrats. Politics is a zero-sum game. And every extra vote they get through unlawful interpretations of Section 2 hurts us.
And Democrats in the state of Arizona sued. They allege that both of these provisions in the state violate federal law on the basis of race, discrimination on the basis of race under the Voting Rights Act of 1965.
No right is more precious in a democracy than the right to vote and to have that vote counted. That is what Section 2 protects.
And so what the justices are going to decide and this major decision is whether these Arizona laws can stand, whether they pass muster, or whether they are in fact discriminatory.
If you just can't vote for those reasons and your vote is not being counted, you've been denied the right to vote, haven't you?
Does Arizona have to wait for fraud to occur in Arizona?
But much more significant, Avery, is what the justices will say about how to determine when a state voting rule is racially discriminatory.
If it takes one opportunity away, I guess I still don't understand why that isn't reducing the ability of those voters to vote.
They've never weighed in on that question under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. And what language they use there could make it much harder to challenge, as you know, this unprecedented wave of state voting restrictions that we've seen enacted by Republicans on the basis of President Trump's lies and this effort to push back on some of the outcomes of the 2020 election.
Georgia is one of at least 15 GOP-led states that has passed more restrictive voting legislation this year. And Attorney General Merrick Garland says that Georgia law specifically makes it harder for people to vote.
And so are the legal issues in this Arizona case different from the legal issues surrounding Georgia?
The centerpiece in both cases is Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act of 1965.
Our careful assessment of the facts and the law demonstrates that Georgia's recent voting rights law violates Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act.
Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act says no state law can deny or abridge the right to vote on account of race or color. And in the state of Arizona case that we're going to be hearing from the Supreme Court on, the justices will be interpreting that, applying that here, setting a standard going forward. It also happens to be the same provision that the Biden Justice Department is using to take Georgia to court.
And the DOJ is specifically challenging parts of the law that reduce access to absentee voting, arguing that will likely make black voters have to wait in line longer than white voters.
So tying those two things together, Avery, what the Supreme Court says in a couple of days about Section 2 will very much apply to the case going forward from the Justice Department against the state of Georgia.
And this is really the first time that we've seen the court address voting rights since 2013, when it got rid of that provision that required that states with a history of discrimination get federal approval to change voting laws. How could the court's decision impact the larger fight that we're seeing across the country as it relates to voting rights?
Yeah, that was a major decision, highly controversial, 5-4 in 2013.
The heart of this law is the extraordinary exercise of federal power, which the Congress in 1965 said was necessary to put whole states under the supervision of the Justice Department and the federal courts, states that had demonstrated vicious efforts to prevent black people from voting.
And what the Supreme Court said in 2013 is that time has changed things. We've moved past that now. The Congress needs to come up with a new formula for that process, and so effectively they struck it down.
If Georgia had still been covered by Section 5, it is likely that SB 202 would never have taken effect.
And that leaves Section 2, this other provision that's going to be at the forefront of our coverage the next few days, as kind of the last remaining bulwark against racial discrimination in voting. And here's the key, Avery. How will the justices balance the determinations of discrimination in result versus intent?
What concerns me is that your position is going to make every voting rule vulnerable to attack under Section 2.
You see a lot of the Republicans saying you've got to set a higher bar. You need to prove intent and discrimination. It can't just be result. Democrats are saying, well, the text of the law says simply any law that results in discrimination is discrimination. And so the result test is what they're seeing. How the justices balance the result of a given state election law versus the intent of a state election law could make it easier, could make it harder to challenge some of these voting rules in the years ahead.
Well, certainly something that we'll be watching. ABC's Devin Dwyer. Thanks, Devin.
Thanks, Avery.
To show you the numbers, the hottest days ever in Portland. We've hit 107 degrees three times. Well, guess what we just did?
This is dangerous heat, like we've never felt it before here in Western Washington. We're breaking records everywhere you turn.
Extreme heat is scorching parts of the Pacific Northwest, bringing record-setting temperatures in cities like Seattle and Portland.
I can't move around outdoors.
As a life-threatening heat wave now extends to parts of seven states, home to 33 million million people.
ABC News chief meteorologist Ginger Z, our resident expert on all things climate, is here to tell us more. Ginger, when temperatures are so dangerously high in cities where this kind of heat isn't normal, what is the impact on human health and that of the environment?
It's not that places in the Pacific Northwest have never been hot, but they've never been this hot, and they haven't been hot like this for days on end.
A region searching for any sort of relief, with a historic heat dome hovering over the Pacific Northwest.
One other really big factor that makes this specific event different.
We might not even, I've got to update some of these numbers, we might not even get below triple digits at 8 o'clock.
Is that in the overnight, often they'll get this downsloping wind off the mountains and it will save them because temperatures will start to go up, down after 9 o'clock or so, and they'll drop into the 60s.
75 for a low, 80 for a low tomorrow night. Those are our typical daytime high temperatures this time of year.
This time, they're not only setting all-time record highs for the daytime temperatures, but also overnight. It's staying warm. And the body, especially if there's anything else going on in your body, struggles with that.
And what people forget is not many people in this area actually have air conditioning in their homes.
Right. It's not really routine to have an air conditioner in Portland homes. I don't know how
dehydration happens easier. You can have the reaction that is the absolute worst, and that is just a shutdown of organs, especially for folks, too, that are exposed to this for hours on end and for days on end, like farm workers.
That's part of our concern, and that's part of why we've mobilized such an intense response, is that the body can acclimate somewhat to the heat, but it takes about 1 to 2 weeks. So
we think about construction, I think, because a lot of us live in cities and we see that, but think about where your food is coming from, and these are high agricultural places, and we're talking about the whole states, not just Portland, not just Seattle, and so I think those are the folks that are going to be feeling this the most.
And we're only about a week into summer, and temperatures in cities out west could go as high as 30 degrees above normal. Is this a direct effect of climate change?
We often shy away from taking one event and saying, yes, this is climate change. However, with heat and prolonged drought, it is a much easier connection. What we do know is that with climate change, we will see longer duration, more frequent, and more intense heat waves. That's what this is.
And the record-setting heat wave happening near the Arctic Circle in Russia. Temperatures near 120 degrees there. Unfathomable.
When looking at what happened in Siberia with the ground temperature reaching 118 degrees above the Arctic Circle, you had Moscow having an all-time June record. You had St. Petersburg making temperatures the hottest since 1998. This is not just something that's happening here. We're seeing in Russia, they're actually warming at 2.5 times the rate of the globe. And as you get closer to that Arctic Circle and up into the Arctic, some of these native groups that have lived there for eons are having to change and move. They are the true climate refugee.
There is this year-to-year variability, but what I can say with confidence is that climate change is going to make heat waves like this become more and more common.
And it's not just about one heat wave. It is about a prolonged above average, which is exactly what's been happening in Siberia. If you look at April and both May, they've been 6 to 10 degrees above average. Not a half a degree, which is what we usually say when we're, oh, you know, overall it's been above average. No, no, no. 6 to 10 degrees above.
So the problem is we're getting these heat waves in Siberia, which are melting the sea ice earlier and earlier. And then when fall happens and the, you know, it becomes much colder in Siberia, as we know, the ocean still has all of this heat, and this heat in the ocean is preventing the sea ice to form.
You know, people always say when we see things like this, oh, we don't know what the Earth was like, and we do know that the Arctic had palm trees. We sure do, because we have paleoclimatology. What's different right now is that we have never seen this rapid rate of change so quickly, even in paleoclimatology, and there is only one thing that's different, and that's us.
All right, that's Ginger Z. Stay cool. Thank you.
Thank you, you too.
Next up, we'll start here. How one spectator caused a chaotic start for the world's most famous bike race. That's coming up.
With so much
at stake. So much on the line, more Americans turn here than any other newscast. ABC News, World News Tonight with David Muir.
We have made it through another week together.
America's number one most watched newscast across all of television. Friday nights, 9, 8 Central. True crime, cinematic, real-life drama, stunning, the unthinkable. Follow the clues, the hunt, true crime, 2020. Friday nights, 9, 8 Central on ABC.
The reality is our country can collapse from within.
You see the white power movement on the march. Klansmen and neo-Nazis, skinheads, it's meant to incite war.
From the KKK to Oklahoma City to Charlottesville, the new documentary event special.
We just need to start talking about race.
Homegrown hate, the war among us.
This is a real wake-up call.
Streaming now on ABC News Live.
Now, when it matters most, the straightforward facts. ABC News is America's number one news. Good morning, America. Number one in the morning, 9 years running. World News Tonight with David Muir. Number one in the evening with America's most watched newscast, 2020. The number one news magazine on Friday nights. The View, the number one daytime talk show. And ABC News Live, number one in streaming news. ABC News is America's number one news.
And one last thing.
That was a little closer than 126 as they got under that banner. Oh, the massive crash there. What has happened?
A crash near the start of the Tour de France Saturday sent cyclists flying over their handlebars.
Oh, it was the sign that the rider in front hit.
The cause of the pileup? A spectator who got a little too close with a cardboard sign, appearing to pose for a photo.
And he just hit the side of the road and lost the front wheel.
That sign knocked over German rider Tony Martin, triggering a domino effect of fallen riders, broken bikes, and bloody injuries. Race officials are reportedly planning to sue that spectator.
The riders are just blocked across the road. They can't pass anywhere.
Now, this isn't the first time a photo op has turned dangerous.
Tonight, screams of horror at the Grand Canyon.
About a year ago, a 59-year-old woman stepped off the edge of the Grand Canyon to her death taking photos. Similarly, in October, a man died falling 250 feet off a cliff in Arizona, snapping shots. And according to a study in the Journal of Family Medicine and Primary Care, 259 people died taking selfies from 2011 to 2017. In France, the message from race officials after the crash was simple: don't risk everything for a photo. More on all of these stories and more at abcnews.com or the ABC News app. I'm Avery Harper, and I'll see you tomorrow.
ABC News, World News Tonight with David Muir.
We have made it through another week together.
America's number one most watched newscast across all of television.
Admit it. These days, what you need to know
seems to change just about every day.
What is it that you really want to know, need to know?
To help you not just get through your day,
but to make the most of it. Feel smarter.
Feel better.
Feel happier.
Well, how about a third hour of Good Morning America in the afternoon?
GMA 3, what you need to know. Lunchtime at 1 Eastern, 12 Central and Pacific on ABC. It's all about you. Robin Roberts, George Stephanopoulos, Michael Strahan. Wake up with America's number one most watched morning show, ABC's
Good Morning America.
The world may feel out of your control, but your happiness doesn't have to be. Learn the secrets to happiness. Listen to the 10% Happier podcast, free on Apple Podcasts.
ABC News, honored winner for the second straight year with the Edward R. Murrow Award for Overall Excellence in Television. ABC News, America's number one news source. Friday nights, 9, 8 Central. True crime, cinematic, real-life drama, stunning, the unthinkable. Follow the clues, the hunt, true crime, 2020. Friday nights, 9, 8 Central on ABC.
This is a story of two brothers, one hero and the other a monster.
So much terror in such a beautiful place.
Evil in Eden, Friday at 9, 8 central on ABC. ABC News, straightforward.
Good morning, I'm Diane Macedo. Thanks for streaming with us. In today's update, the search for survivors hit day five at a collapsed high-rise in Surfside, Florida. At least nine people are confirmed dead and more than 150 are unaccounted for. Now an engineering report from 2018 is raising new questions. And Bill Barr is not mincing words. The former attorney general is opening up about his fight with then-President Trump after revealing there was no evidence of election fraud. Chief Washington correspondent Jonathan Carl joins us live with that interview and what the former president is saying now. And the BET Awards were full of surprises, from Cardi B's show-stopping announcement to Megan Thee Stallion snagging three major awards and Lil Nas X's historic kiss.
People are really happy that I went out there and did that.
And all hail Queen Latifah, who celebrated her Lifetime Achievement Award. We have a full wrap-up. But we begin with the search for survivors in Surfside, Florida, as rescue efforts stretch into their fifth day. At least nine people have been killed. More than 150 are still unaccounted for, as more than 400 rescuers are working around the clock. ABC's TJ Holmes is in Surfside with the latest.
Officials identified four more victims overnight, among them 26-year-old Luis Bermundez and his mother. As the desperate search for survivors enters its fifth day, this morning, crews and officials working around the clock, refusing to give up hope.
We just need a few more miracles each day.
The death toll climbed to at least nine overnight, more than 150 still unaccounted for. Rescue teams arriving from Israel and Mexico to support the operation. 6 to 8 squads scouring the massive destruction at any given time, pouring through the rubble left behind after this horrifying moment of collapse. This whole section of the Champlain Towers South now gone. 12 stories pancaking to the ground, the way the building collapsed, leaving some hope that voids or pockets of air could form in the rubble, large enough for someone to survive. And now, new questions about the Champlain Towers. The city of Surfside releasing documents from 2018 estimating the cost was $9.1 million to address issues raised in a 2018 report that found major structural damage to the concrete below the pool deck, including failed waterproofing. An engineering report from that same year identified significant structural damage to some parts of the building. Now, concerns growing about the tower's sister buildings nearby. These photos from Champlain Towers East showing chunks of concrete missing from columns in the parking garage. One expert tells us the damage in those images alone would not cause a complete system failure, but some residents refusing to take any chances. Fiorella Terenzi, who has lived in that building for 21 years, now leaving over fears her home could collapse and health concerns.
I wanted to stay. I wanted to help the community. At the same time, the mix of dust, smoke, fire, pollutants, the air started to be very difficult for me to breathe.
Also this morning, growing concerns over Champlain Towers North, similar in construction and age to the building that collapsed. Surfside Mayor Charles Burkett says they're urging people to evacuate, but not mandating it.
I don't know if I'd be comfortable staying in that building until I knew for sure that they had done a comprehensive top-to-bottom study on what's going on with the systems in that building.
And Diane, back in 1995 in Seoul, South Korea, building collapsed. A woman was pulled out of that rubble after 16 days. You go back to 2013, Bangladesh, a man was pulled out after 17 days after building collapsed there. Go back to 2010, that Haiti earthquake, someone was pulled out of the rubble after 27 days. So you have stories like that, and the word is not unlikely. The fact of the matter is, it's not unprecedented for people to be pulled out of the rubble after many days and many weeks even. So hope is the word here until otherwise noted, Diane.
Yep, that's why we're seeing those rescue teams still working around the clock. TJ Holmes in Surfside, Florida, thank you. Meanwhile, families are growing more and more desperate for news of their loved ones. Some are holding out hope, as TJ said. Others are looking for closure. ABC's Victor Okendo has their stories.
This is our command and control and planning tent.
ABC News getting an inside look at the base of operations for Miami-Dade Fire Rescue's Florida Task Force 1, an elite unit that's been deployed to disasters all over the world, but this one hit home.
What keeps you guys going?
For assistance personnel. Team members know folks, individuals that are trapped in that debris, that were victims in this event.
The process is painstaking. Relatives asked for DNA samples to help identify those found in the rubble and for unique characteristics for the missing, such as tattoos and scars. Jake Samuelson, whose grandparents Arnie and Miriam Notkin lived on the third floor, says that his family has gotten 16 phone calls from the apartment landline, only to pick up and hear static on the other end.
We're just trying to rationalize what's happening here, and we're just trying to get answers.
Earlier this morning, Robin Roberts speaking with Miami-Dade Fire Rescue Chief Andy Alvarez about the search and rescue efforts.
We have the latest technology as far as rescue equipment. We got DELSAR systems that can hear. We got underground sonar systems that can detect victims. We brought in huge cranes to help us lift big slabs of concrete, and obviously that's going to aid us so that we can get inside and again find those voids that we know might possibly be there and you know, rescue those people.
And Victor Kendall joins me live now from Surfside. Victor, what are you hearing from engineers about the issues raised in that 2018 report?
Diane, I have spoken with a number of engineers since this happened, and they all tell me pretty much the same thing, that they believe it's going to be multiple factors that contributed to this collapse. But let's tell you a little bit more about the 2018 report itself, released by the city of Surfside, showing the estimated cost of the mandatory 40-year recertification process was $9.1 million. This was to address issues raised in that 2018 report that found, quote, major structural damage to the concrete below the pool deck, including failed waterproofing. Engineers also filing another document right around the same time describing the overall concrete framing as being in good condition. So there are still so many questions, and unfortunately they won't be answered for some time, because this investigation is going to take weeks, months, maybe even longer. And again, the priority here on the ground, Diane, is still on search and rescue.
And Victor, on that note, the fire chief says that they found some voids or air pockets within the rubble, and that's allowed them to be able to kind of tunnel through the building. How important is that at this stage?
It is critical, but keep in mind, as I've been saying, this is a dangerous but delicate operation. Here's what Chief Kaminsky said just yesterday, that if there is a void space, we want to make sure we're given every possibility for survival, and that's why we can't just go in and move things around radically, because that is going to have the worst possible outcome. So you have the safety of the crews and the safety of any possible survivors on the line. Diane?
And Victor, as we listen for updates, what are you watching for today?
Well, we're waiting for an update in a few hours here from officials. So, of course, the one thing we are all hoping for is word on any survivors, and then we'll see if the numbers have changed at all overnight. One thing I should mention, while it did rain pretty early this morning, it does seem like they've got the fires under control. We just have to see if the elements will be on their side today. The way the mayor of Surfside has put it, given all the fires they've had to deal with and the rough weather and the stifling heat, they haven't had a resources problem here. They've had a luck problem. Diane?
All right. Crossing fingers for a little bit of good luck there in Surfside today. Victor Kendo, thank you. And former Attorney General Bill Barr is speaking out for the first time about former President Trump's false claims that the election was stolen. Barr tells our chief Washington correspondent Jonathan Carl that he personally looked into Trump's allegations of fraud and found there was nothing there. Now Trump is unleashing on Barr, calling him a disappointment in every sense of the word. Jonathan Carl has the story.
Bill Barr doesn't mince words. In a series of exclusive interviews, he tells me he investigated Donald Trump's claims shortly after the election and found there was just nothing there, and it was all BS.
If I found something, yeah, you know, I had no motive to suppress it. But my suspicion all the way along was that there was nothing there. It was all
Barr told me he conducted his own informal inquiry into the major allegations Trump himself was making. He examined the evidence, he talked to the experts, he took them seriously, but it was all bunk. For example, he talked to cybersecurity experts at the Department of Homeland Security and the FBI about allegations that voting machines were rigged.
You can tell me all you want to about, you know,
boxes could have been hacked or, you know, whatever. But it's a counting machine, and we save everything that was counted. So you just reconcile the two. There's a pile right there. How many ballots? 1,000.
Right.
Now let's see who they're for. There's been no discrepancy reported anywhere that's looked at that, and I'm still not aware of any discrepancy.
On December 1st, when Barr was still Attorney General, he publicly declared there was no evidence of widespread fraud, prompting Donald Trump to explode in anger during a meeting at the White House. Multiple sources who witnessed the president's reaction told me they had never seen him so angry. One said, quote, "He had the eyes and mannerisms of a madman. How the expletive could you do this to me? Why did you say it?" Trump demanded. "Because it's true," Barr replied. "You must hate Trump," the president responded. "You must hate Trump."
And John Carl joins me live now for more on this. John, Barr was seen as one of Trump's most loyal cabinet members. So what do you think the fallout will be from hearing him speak so bluntly about this?
Well, you're exactly right on this. What makes this so significant is he was perhaps the most loyal cabinet member, seen as the most loyal cabinet member. But more important than even that is that Barr was considered the most popular cabinet member among the Trump base, among the people that are out there right now who actually believe what the president has said, his lies about the election being stolen, about election fraud. So now you have that individual. This isn't some Republican in Congress or somebody that was critical of Trump. This is Bill Barr. This is the guy that stood behind Trump throughout the Russia investigation. And he, even Bill Barr, the ultimate Trump loyalist in his cabinet, is saying that there is nothing to these allegations, that he looked into them, and they're all, as you heard in his word, BS.
BS. He went right for it with that one. John, I know you also spoke with Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell about this. What was he saying to Barr as this whole thing was going on?
Well, this is another. There's so many remarkable elements to this story, and frankly, to what was going on during these final months of the Trump administration. You know, I have been spending a lot of time over the last several months talking to all the key players, all the people that were around the president, and you know, in his administration, outside his administration, about what was going on after the election when the president was making these outrageous allegations, in preparation for writing a book about all of this. And one of the details here that is so remarkable is that McConnell, who had said nothing publicly about these allegations until the middle of December, McConnell called Bill Barr on multiple occasions, and this account has been confirmed by not just McConnell but also Barr. So both men have told me this is accurate. That McConnell called him and was urging him, in fact, pleading with him to come out and publicly contradict the president's claims about election fraud, to come out and say there was nothing to it. So McConnell was doing this even as he himself was saying nothing about it. And here's the kicker on this is McConnell told Barr, "I can't do it because I need him in Georgia," meaning he couldn't come out and say there was no fraud, that the claims were bogus, because McConnell was worried about the two runoff elections in Georgia, those two Georgia senators that had runoff elections on January 5th. And McConnell was worried that if he came out and said Biden legitimately won, there's nothing to these claims of fraud, that he would enrage Donald Trump so much that it would jeopardize those two Republican senators who were up for those runoff elections in Georgia. And he called repeatedly to Barr and said, "You're really the only one that can do it." And ultimately, Barr did it. Barr did it. He came out not as bluntly as he did in the interview with me, but on December 1st, he came out and the language back then was, "There is no evidence of widespread voter fraud that could have tipped the scales of the election."
And I saw on your Twitter feed this morning, John, that now former President Trump is going after McConnell, too.
the former president has put out a statement. It is a remarkable statement, both in terms of its content and its length. It is goes on for a few pages, and it viciously attacks First of all, Barr calling him a rhino, a Republican in name only. And then it goes after McConnell, who in the statement Trump calls another beauty. And he's accusing both of these people of not being real Republicans because they have both now come out, perhaps belatedly in both cases, and said that there's nothing to these fraud claims.
Now, John, Trump still holds a lot of power in the Republican Party. How much of an impact do you think this will have on that?
Well, you know, it's such a good question, and the honest answer is I don't know. You would think that having somebody of the stature within the Trump base as Bill Barr coming out and speaking so bluntly, it would have a big impact. But there have been so many moments where you would have thought that Republicans now finally would say, you know, enough. There's nothing to what the former president is saying. It is time to move on. The bottom line, though, you saw it in Ohio. There is no other Republican in the country that can attract the kind of crowds that Donald Trump can attract, who has the kind of support among rank and file Republicans, even after all of this. Will this have an impact? I think this will have somewhat of an impact. But at the end of the day, at the end of this day, he's still going to be the most influential Republican in the country.
All right, Chief Washington correspondent John Carl. John, thank you. And your book on the last days of the Trump administration betrayal is out everywhere in November. John, congrats on that as well.
Thank you.
And overnight, President Biden ordered airstrikes near the Iraq-Syria border. The airstrikes targeted Iranian-backed militias. The administration says they're in retaliation for recent attacks against U.S. troops and facilities in Iraq. Rachel Scott is at the White House with more. Good morning, Rachel.
Diane, good morning. And this is the second time that President Biden has ordered airstrikes in this region. We are told that this is meant to send a very clear and direct message to these militia groups backed by Iran that there will be serious consequences if U.S. forces continue to be threatened or attacked. Now, take a look at this video released just overnight showing the moments these airstrikes were carried out. At this time, it's unclear if there were any casualties. Defense officials say that the targets were three facilities behind recent drone attacks on American troops in Iraq. The Pentagon is describing this as a defensive strike, calling it necessary to address the threat. But this escalation does come at a critical time when talks have been underway to see if the U.S. and Iran can return to that landmark nuclear accord that former President Donald Trump withdrew from. Now, these militia groups are already vowing revenge. They say they will continue to target U.S. forces. Diane?
All right, Rachel Scott at the White House. Rachel, thank you. And the highly contagious Delta variant is leading to a surge in COVID hospitalizations. States with low vaccination rates are particularly vulnerable. ABC's Ellen Lopez is outside CDC headquarters in Atlanta with the latest. Ellen, good morning.
Hey, Diane, good morning. Even as COVID cases drop across the country, there are pockets where infections are rising. That Delta variant, a major threat in the fight against the virus, especially in states with low vaccination rates. Hospitalizations in Arizona, Arkansas, and Nevada are surging all up by nearly 20% or more. And that highly contagious strain of the virus has now been detected in all but one state. Missouri now becoming a hotspot for that variant. Hospitalizations there at their highest level since March. And in Israel, they are now reimposing its indoor mask mandates just 10 days after lifting them amid a surge in cases related to that highly contagious strain. The prime minister there is urging those who are not vaccinated to get that arm to needle. Diane.
All right, Ellen Lopez in Atlanta. Thanks, Ellen. And now to that life-threatening heat in the West. Nearly 25 million people are under excessive heat warnings. Our Rob Marciano's in Portland, Oregon, where they could set an all-time record for the third straight day.
Hey, good morning, Diane. The furnace is on full blast here in the Pacific Northwest. This is a historic climate change amplified heat wave. We hit 112 degrees yesterday. The old record 2 days ago was 107, so we've really blown that out by 5 degrees. It hit 104 in Seattle, all-time record there. Lytton, BC in Canada, 116 in British Columbia. That's an all-time record for the entire country of Canada. And I tell you, this part of the world, you know, not everybody has air conditioning. So if your air conditioning breaks down, I've had some friends who've had that happen. Good luck getting a technician. There's been a run on portable air conditioners in the store. If you can't get one of those, you go to this cooling center I'm standing next to where over 200 people are housed. They've got food, they've got water, they've got cots, and most importantly, they've got the air conditioning there. They're loading up water to deliver to folks who need them. 80,000 bottles of water the Multnomah County has on staff, and the volunteers are helping deliver those. We went out and saw just how hot it was in the streets yesterday. These temperatures are typically measured in the shade. You go out to the streets, the asphalt, we measured 157 degree temperature there. And people are living on the streets here. There's been an explosion of houseless or homeless population here in the last couple of years. All right, 115, that's expected high temperature today, third day in a row of an all-time record. We expect maybe even getting to 110 in Seattle, seven states in this heat wave, 13 million under heat alerts, and not really cooling off all that much tomorrow along the I-5 corridor. Matter of fact, the entire Northwest will remain warm, well above average through the rest of the week. Diane.
All right, Rob Marciano, thank you. And now let's get more on that forecast and the latest on when this heat will subside. ABC News Chief Meteorologist Ginger Z has more on that. Hi, Ginger.
Diane, we are sandwiched between the heat from the west to the east. Right here in the middle of the country, there was a state of emergency here in Michigan. We had more than 5 inches in Grand Haven, but more than a half foot on the east side of the state. You can see what that resulted in. Some really big troubles on highways. Those trucks just underwater and just submerged in there. Well, unfortunately, those flood alerts stretch all the way back to New Mexico and Texas today. The bulk of the rain looks like somewhere between Oklahoma, eastern Kansas, into Kansas City, and up to Chicago. And so flash flood alerts are up, and that means that the 1 to 4 inches happens very quickly, and you're already super saturated in a lot of these places, targeting 3 to 5 inches in any of those yellow, orange, and reds. So keep an eye on that, especially if you have plans to drive. Now, I mentioned that we were sandwiched between that all-time record heat in the Pacific Northwest, this blocking pattern set up, the trough here, and then look at the heat, the ridge building and staying. This will be a legitimate heat wave, meaning 90 plus for a lot of folks from Wilmington, Delaware, all the way up to Bangor, Maine. You've got heat advisories in place, so you'll feel close to 100 or 105 degrees. And the temperatures, the actual air temperatures, will stay in the 90s, 96 and 95 both Tuesday and Wednesday for New York City. Boston, even getting into the mid and even upper 90s. So hot, hot, hot as we get into summer, Diane.
All right, Ginger Z, thank you. And want to know what it's like to be on the first cruise to set sail from the U.S. since the pandemic? When we return, our Gio Benitez is on that ship with a first-hand look.
Now, when it matters most, the straightforward facts. ABC News is America's number one news. Good Morning America, number one in the morning, 9 years running. World News Tonight with David Muir, number one in the evening with America's most watched newscast. 2020, the number one news magazine on Friday nights. The View, the number one daytime talk show. And ABC News Live, number one in streaming news. ABC News is America's number one news. The most powerful stories of our time, anytime. Nightline. Friday nights, 9, 8 Central. True crime. Cinematic. Real-life drama. Stunning. The unthinkable. Follow the clues. The hunt. True crime. 2020. Friday nights, 9, 8 Central on ABC.
Admit it. These days, what you need to know
seems to change just about every day.
What is it that you really want to know, need to know?
To help you not just get through your day,
but to make the most of it. Feel smarter.
Feel better.
Feel happier.
Well, how about a third hour of Good Morning America in the afternoon?
GMA 3, what you need to know. Lunchtime at 1 Eastern, 12 Central and Pacific on ABC. It's all about you.
I know what happened, and I'm not guilty.
Why the fascination with criminal trials? Figure out what's really out there.
She revealed she had murdered his family.
I know in my heart they did this.
It's the time of suspicion.
The ending's really tough.
You don't know whether truth is going to be difficult to find unless you try to find it.
Do you believe?
reality is our country can collapse from within.
You see the white power movement on the march. Klansmen and neo-Nazis, skinheads, it's meant to incite war.
From the KKK to Oklahoma City to Charlottesville, the new documentary event special.
We just need to start talking about race.
Homegrown hate, the war among us.
This is a real wake-up call.
Streaming now on ABC News Live.
Welcome back. A cruise ship has set sail from the U.S. for the first time since the pandemic started. The Celebrity Edge launched from Florida with 100% of adults on board vaccinated. Transportation correspondent Gio Benitez is on board with more.
This morning, America at sea.
What's it like to be back?
It's our honeymoon. It's our delayed honeymoon. Life is good today.
On board the Celebrity Edge, all adult passengers are fully vaccinated. No masks or social distancing. And that buffet, it's open, but crew members serve the food.
We're told right now that this is a fully vaccinated sailing. If it wasn't, would you have gotten on?
Yes. We would have.
Really? Why?
Because we love to cruise.
The Edge, beginning its journey in Florida, which is at the center of a bitter dispute with the CDC over vaccine mandates. As the public remembers those images of cruise ships with outbreaks last year.
Don't sugarcoat it. Don't look at it through rose-colored glasses. You got a big problem, and you're going to need big solutions. And so we worked on that.
Richard Fain is the chairman and CEO of Royal Caribbean, which owns Celebrity. A federal judge ruling this month that cruise ships in Florida cannot mandate vaccines.
What happens when you start seeing larger numbers of unvaccinated passengers?
Well, the vast bulk of our guests want vaccination. That's part of our policy, that we need the vast bulk of people on board to be vaccinated.
The unvaccinated, he says, will pay for their own testing before, during, and at the end of the cruise. Masks will be required for those passengers, and they'll have separate seating.
Even with the vaccine, there will be isolated cases.
Just 3 weeks ago, two adults staying in the same room tested positive aboard the Celebrity Millennium in the Caribbean. And on Thursday, two children tested positive on Royal Caribbean's Adventure of the Seas.
Let's say I'm in contact with someone who tests positive later on. What happens to me? Where do I go?
Well, as soon as you're identified, and you will be fairly quickly because we have that technology, then we will isolate you, and then we will test you right away.
Meanwhile, the cruise industry supports more than 400,000 American jobs.
It's not even just the jobs that are associated with the cruise industry. There's all of these branches, you know, that supply cruise lines.
Captain Kate McHugh, the first female captain of a megaship, gaining a TikTok following of almost 2 million during the pandemic, spending most of the past 15 months on this ship.
318 days straight.
What was that like?
It was amazing. The stripes came off, crew members became friends and family.
And Captain Kate says she really felt a responsibility to be here during that time, especially to get all of the employees back home. She says that was a monumental task, and she did not see her husband for 7 months straight. But you know, Diane, I gotta tell you, this really feels like pre-pandemic times here, because as we talked about, every adult passenger on board is fully vaccinated. Only the 24 children here are not. And so that's why these passengers and this ship are making history. Diane.
All right, transportation correspondent Gio Benitez, looks like you're all having a great time. Safe travels. And last night's BET Awards were full of surprises, from Cardi B to Megan Thee Stallion. When we come back, we go backstage with the stars and hear from them on how it felt to be back on stage live in front of a real audience. We'll be right back.